Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit SurreyFarms.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
All right. Thank you so much for tuning in to the Heritage Radio Network. We are coming to you live, as always, from the back of Roberta's Pizza here in Bushwick, Brooklyn. And today you are listening to the Farm Report. I'm your host, Erin Fairbanks, and we are going to talk about an interesting type of farming, a type of farming I'm not at all familiar with, salt farming. And we are on the line with the brother and sister team, Nancy and Lewis, of J.Q. Dickinson Saltworks. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So lovely to have you guys on. So you're down in Malden, West Virginia, and you guys are seventh generation salt makers. Is that right?
That's correct.
Wow. So I guess I want to start at the beginning. You know, there was light and there was dark, and well, maybe not quite that far back. But how did your family come to the salt making business?
Ancestor William Dickinson lived in Bedford County, Virginia, which is near Lynchburg, and he heard about the salt springs in the Kanawha County area of Virginia, and he saw an opportunity. So he and his brother-in-law came across the mountains, and they started a salt enterprise.
So I just for folks who aren't familiar, and I'm going to count myself in this group, can you maybe give us a sense of, you know, what are the variety of ways that one produces salt, and where does kind of your operation fit in that kind of spectrum? Is it a normal way? Is it kind of off the cuff? Is it special in certain ways? If we can just get a sense of kind of an overview of how most salt that we're consuming is produced and kind of where you guys are set apart in your model.
Sure. I guess most people think of sea salt as one type of salt, which is made from ocean water. And then there's mined salt, rock salt, which Morton salt is made that way. Also, there's a salt mined in Utah. Our salt comes from an underground brine aquifer. It's a 400 million year old ancient sea that is trapped below this area of West Virginia. And so we basically have a water well that we've drilled to the strata, and we pump the brine up and then evaporate it by solar evaporation in special sun houses. So it's a very different process than a lot. And there's only one other salt in the world that we know of that's made from underground brine, and that's made in Peru.
So underground brine, if I'm just imagining correctly, it's basically like I dig a hole deep into the ground and I hit a big, you know, space of salty water. Is that more or less the gist?
Yes.
And I'm just curious, you know, when Dickinson was getting started, I mean, how far down, how do they know that the brine aquifer was there?
Brine, at that point, was bubbling up out of the ground, and there were a lot of animal tracks, and Native Americans were using it to make salt and cure their meats. But to get to the more saturated brine, you have to go deeper. So in order to drill, per se, they actually used hollowed out sycamore trees, and they drove them into the ground as the casing. And so they drop a man down into the hollowed out sycamore, and he would send buckets of water up and mud to get it deeper and deeper. So it took our ancestors over 2 years to drill their first well. It took us about 3 weeks, and we thought that was a long time.
So there was it sounds like there was a gap in the production, that the family was producing the salt for a while and then stopped. What happened?
Yeah, the Dickinsons, actually, our ancestors were the last ones to produce here in Kanawha County. They were producing all the way up until 1945. But the biggest reason that the salt industry dissipated in this area was around 1861. There was a huge flood, which basically overtook what then was about 52 different furnaces. And at that about that time, Kanawha County was one of the largest salt-producing areas in the country. And the markets were such at that time that it didn't make sense for most of the families to come back and rebuild, but the Dickinsons decided to do it. And they lasted until 1945, and they were the last ones, and actually kept producing brine for chemical industry up until the 80s. But then Nancy and I started it back this summer, so we're reviving it.
So, I mean, you guys were what, just sitting around the kitchen table thinking, like, hey, we got some extra time on our hands. Let's, you know, revisit this 200-year-old, you know, family tradition. I mean, what was the impetus for getting back into the salt business?
A couple of things. One, I'm a chef by training, and I just always watch food trends. And several years ago, I guess probably 10 years ago, I was on a trip in Europe and had some salt from Sweden, which just blew me away. I didn't realize at the time that there was really a difference in salt, and the salt I tasted was just amazing. And so I got kind of hooked into the salt trends and started watching it grow and saw what was happening. At the same time, my husband is a student getting his master's degree in American history. He's actually a PhD student now, but he wrote his master's thesis on the industrialization of this valley, the Kanawha Valley. So he was learning about our family, through a totally different lens. And while he was doing research, I started thinking, you know, why aren't we making salt anymore? And I asked him one day, I said, did they stop making salt because the brine ran out? And he said, oh, no, there's plenty of brine there. It just economic circumstances changed. And I said, you know, we need to be making salt. We could really have an opportunity, especially when, you know, this growing movement of chefs and consumers who are really aware of where their food is produced and want to know where their food is produced. I saw an opportunity, and I called Lewis, and I said, I think we need to start a business. So he said yes, and here we are.
And here we are. Well, I want to tuck into some of the logistical aspects of that process. But before we go further, I would love if you could maybe describe the salt for us. I mean, I think, you know, you really hit the nail on the head that, you know, the evolution of cooking and the way home cooks and people are thinking about food has grown pretty dramatically in the last couple of decades. And now it's not uncommon to, you know, pop over to your friend's house and they've got, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 different types of salt that you can choose from depending on what you're going to be cooking and what stage of the cooking process you're in. So maybe you can tell us a little bit about the flavor and the texture and where you see your salt kind of fitting into the cooking process.
Sure. We consider it more of a finishing salt. It's crunchy. It's not a delicate slate like, say, a Malden salt. A lot of people are familiar with that. They're famous pyramidal, very thin flakes. Ours is a little chunkier. It's a very bold flavor, yet balanced. It's delicious, is what we call it. It has a certain minerality and brininess to it.
It's crunchy and it pops, and we feel like you don't have to use as much because you're getting the full flavor from it. And, you know, another great story that came out of this was, it used to be known as the Great Kanawha Salt, and it was red. And, you know, back in the day, they didn't have refrigerators, so salt was key. And it was key to preserving meats. And the salt from Kanawha County was entered in the first World's Fair in London and won first prize in 1851. So we think that's a great part of our story.
Yeah, it sounds like there's a lot of different historical components. One of the other things I thought was interesting is you actually post on your website the kind of nutritional information about the salt, mostly obviously sodium, some calcium, say some magnesium, and then some other trace minerals. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about, it never really occurred to me to think about the nutritional components of salt or what is in salt or maybe what's not in salt. And maybe you can give us a sense of, as consumers, what should we be kind of looking for or expecting with regards to the nutritive benefits or maybe dangers of salt?
Well, iodized salt has iodine in it, but it also it has anti-caking agents in it, which are aluminum-based, I think, which, that's not natural, and that's not something we should really be consuming, most likely. So we're an all-natural product, and you're getting these other, just a trace of these other essential minerals. Calcium, magnesium is a big one, and potassium. So it's, it adds a little extra, and we feel at 94% sodium chloride as opposed to 99% sodium chloride, you're getting less sodium, but ours has a bigger flavor, so you can actually use less but taste more.
All right, so you decide you're going to get back into the salt-making business. I'm guessing the first step is, finding a place to drill to reach the aquifer. Is that right?
Right. Yeah, we have local consultants that helped us with that. We actually went back to the original family farm here that was purchased by the Dickinsons in 1838, although they had been in the area for salt earlier than that. But we went back to the original farm, and we found in the old company store the old logbooks that told us exactly where the brine was going to be. And that actually came to truth. So we were using their old records for what we were doing in the drilling process, which was kind of neat.
So when you drill, you're setting up, is it a pump system? Is there multiple pumps? What's the process for extracting the brine?
Yeah, our well is about 350 feet down, and we've got a small pump at the bottom of it. And we flip a switch and open the spigot, and brine comes out, and whenever it's needed. So, we feel like the supply is there, that it's replenished itself, the pressure's good, and it's perfectly clear. It's beautiful to witness. So,
now when it comes out, does it just look like water, or?
It is. It's perfectly clear at first, and then the iron in it will oxidize, so it will change color. But then we actually let the iron fall out of it so that it's perfectly clear again by the time we hose it into the beds.
So it's you're pumping it out, and then is there a collection point that then you use to then you transport it to the beds, or you pump it and filter it and put it directly into the beds? How does it get from kind of the pump to the bed?
Yeah, we don't need to filter it, really. The only thing we do is we put it in a storage tank, which is, we've got a tank that's 2,500 gallons, and we naturally let the iron fall out of it. They didn't used to do that, and that's why it used to be the Great Canal Red Salt, but ours is now perfectly white and beautiful because we do let the iron fall out of it. But then from the tank, we hose it again just through gravity. The water will hose into the greenhouse, into the beds, and we fill them up 3 or 4 inches and let nature take its course.
So when you say you let the iron fall out, is that like when I make my French press coffee and the coffee grounds and the sediment, if I let it sit long enough, just falls to the bottom? Or is it something more precise than that?
That's pretty much what it does. The iron gets heavier as it oxidizes, and it falls to the bottom. It just settles down to the bottom of the tank, and then we feed it off the side of the tank through big hoses. through gravity into the greenhouse.
And
well, we also, if I could, we also want to use the iron so there's no waste to the process. We want to convert it into salt and animal licks, and so we really do limit our waste.
Yeah, that was my next question. So that iron that you said you make into, like, salt licks for animals, so that's just like a block that, you know, different animals like to lick, I guess.
Right. We haven't made any yet. It's amazing how little bit of an iron can color the brine. So we're collecting the iron, and we're doing research on what it would take to make the animal licks. But we think that is a good use for us, so we can be 100% using of our product. We
yeah.
want zero waste.
That makes sense. I definitely have memories, not pleasant memories, of being a little kid and testing the salt licks that my dad used to buy when he was baiting deer. Well, if the deer are going to lick it, I want to see what it tastes like. not something I'd recommend. Well, I'm going to ask you to hang tight. We're going to take just a short break. And when we come back, I want to kind of continue down the exploration of the salt making process. So hold on. We'll be right back.
Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons. Edwards Suriano hams are aged to perfection for no less than 400 days and hickory smoked to achieve a deep mahogany color. The Edwards name is well known for its world-class aged and cured meats. Their exclusive curing and aging recipe produces a unique flavor profile that enhances the quality characteristics of Berkshire pork. Optimum amounts of pure white fat marbling contribute to a flavor that's a delicate, perfect balance between sweet and salty. For more information, visit www.surreyfarms.com.
All right, we're back. You're tuned into the Farm Report, and we are talking about salt farming. We're on the line with Nancy Bruins and Lewis Payne of J.Q. Dickinson Salt Works down in Malden, West Virginia. And so we had talked about the salt kind of getting to the beds. So can you describe for folks who've never seen a salt bed, what we're looking at?
We have a couple different greenhouses, but the original one was literally on the floor of the greenhouse, and they would be about 20 by 5, and they would be lined with a black 20-mil plastic, and which would obviously get it really hot. It would get 150 degrees in there, and so during the summer when we fill it up 3 or 4 inches in the bed, and we've had 12 beds in the greenhouse, it would evaporate down to about half within 3 or 4 weeks, and then we'd move it into another longer bed so that it would be not as deep, and we call those the crystallization beds, and they're in those just a few days, and after a few days you'll see the beautiful white crystals, and then we harvest the crystals, and we actually have to let them dry a little bit. And then we will process them and bottle them and market it.
So, I mean, literally, you're basically letting nature take its course. You're putting water, so the salted brine water over kind of a large expanse, and it just evaporates from the kind of heat in the greenhouse. Is there anything else that kind of facilitates the drying process?
Well, you need to control the humidity. In our first greenhouse, we've got an airflow going through there. In theory, you'd like to have a constant airflow with fans, but our mission is to be all natural and to be carbon neutral, so we're not using electricity. But I think ideally, if you had fans that control the humidity, that would be the ideal conditions. But it's heat and then it's humidity, because you want the water to obviously be able to evaporate, but then also to leave the greenhouse. Otherwise, it might condensate and drip back down in the beds, and that would just prolong your process.
So ultimately, the drying process, I mean, really, it sounds like the main ingredient then is just time. And I'm curious, how does it change over the course of the year if you're not using any kind of other inputs with regards to kind of a mechanized, you know, fan or other drying process? Does it get impacted, you know, now it's March, you know, is it a faster drying time or slower? I mean, I guess I would assume the summer would be the fastest because it's the warmest, but maybe that's not the case.
That's definitely the case. Whereas it takes 3 to 4 weeks in the summer, it's been taking almost 3 months over the course of the winter. But the cloudy days and, you know, overcast, all this snow we've been having have slowed us down, but that wasn't really unexpected.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes a slightly different shaped crystal in the winter. We found it's a smaller crystal, and it's like snowflakes almost. It's beautiful.
So the water evaporates off of the bed, and you're left with what I would imagine is, you know, a long expanse covered with the white salt crystals. How do you then, you said then you need to collect and then do another drying process for the crystals, is that right?
Yes, there's a byproduct called bittern, or in Japanese it's called nigari, and it's a liquid mineral byproduct, and it's very nutritional, as well as it's used in making tofu. So we're collecting that. We're getting ready to put that on the market as well. But so we have to separate the salt crystals from the bittern, and we have some tools that were made by a local West Virginia woodworker, Allegheny Treenware in Thornton, West Virginia. And we have a special rake. It's on our website, and a scoop that we use. And so then we harvest the salt into cotton cloths that are very absorbent, and then we take it into our kitchen, our production facility, and let it dry, and then put it in jars.
Interesting. So is there any type of kind of grading or sorting process where, you know, I'm always curious when you get the salt, it's so often like uniform in size. Is that just the natural way it's produced, or is there kind of a separation where you have kind of like larger crystals and then you shake out and you have more fine crystals, or everything just kind of goes like scooped from the drying bag into the jar that I would buy in the store?
No, there definitely are different size crystals, and we keep track of each harvest. You know, we'll harvest some, and then more crystals will be produced in the same bed. And depending on the shape of those crystals, we'll either put them in our first harvest or a second harvest. And we're collecting what we're calling our second harvest would be more of a cooking salt. It's a very, very fine crystal. So we save the best first crystals for our prime product, our finishing salt. And sometimes we do have to grind those up, depending on how quickly the crystals have formed. They get a little bit too big, so we just quickly grind them and get them a little more uniform. So, more pleasant experience.
And then, who is kind of the regulating body for this process? Do you work with the USDA, the Department of Ag and Markets? Who's making sure that you're salt production is, you know, safe for consumption?
We work with the West Virginia Department of Agriculture, as well as the Department of Health and Human Resources. They've all been out to look at our facility and our process, and we have to, you know, let them know if we change anything. We're a little bit outside of their box. We don't fit on any manual that they have. They're like, "What are you doing?" And, you know, they're nervous about water and, you know, contaminants and things like that. And we have to say, look, we're making salt. It's a preservative. It kills bacteria. Nothing can live in it. And it's, you know, there is no shelf life in it. So we have to make them kind of think outside of their normal routine. But they've been great to work with, and actually they're excited about a new industry.
Yeah. I was going to say, I couldn't imagine that they went to the, like, bookshelf and pulled off. They're like, oh, it's our salt farm manual, and now we'll just go out and check the boxes. And Well, I want to talk a little bit about cost. You know, to give folks a sense of, I mean, I think kind of hearing you talk through the process, it seems very hand-on. It seems also like, you know, there's quite a bit of time involved. And so can you run us through, you know, the different types of kind of end-user products that you have and what the general cost range is for them?
Yeah, we sell in three different containers. We sell a smaller jar, which is a one-ounce jar. Doesn't sound like a lot, but it's actually quite a bit, and for $5 retail. And then we sell a larger jar, which is 3.5 ounces, for $9. And then we have 1 pound bags that we sell. We can sell retail or wholesale. Those retail go for $25, and then half of that if we're selling wholesale.
Got it. Well, and that's, too, if folks want to check out the website, it's really beautiful, www.jqdsalt.com. I've got a couple of questions. We're just about out of time, but I want to talk about two more things before we go, because obviously we've been hearing a lot in the national news about kind of water contamination in West Virginia, and I'm wondering, obviously, because that is essentially the brine aquifer is your main you know, resource for the production. What are things that you are doing or that you anticipate doing to make sure that you're able to kind of protect that resource for future generations?
Well, you know, we got that question a lot recently since they've had water issues here in the valley. Fortunately, we're on a farm. We're protected from that water source and those chemical companies. So we're a good bit away from that. You know, through the process, we started testing the brine early on, and just to make sure we knew exactly what was in it. And we actually constantly do that and to make sure there aren't any contaminants. But to be honest with you, that the recent episodes have not been related to what we're doing. It may have slowed our process down because we use water to clean our beds, but it did not affect the quality of our product, but you know, we constantly do test these things and make sure that it's as clean as it always has been for 400 million years. So,
yeah, well, you have plenty of history on your side in that aspect.
Right, and our well is totally cased and protected from any ground contaminants that might get into it. So it. We don't have any worries there as well.
That's great, and that's great to hear. I know it's one of those things that I feel like people following the coverage, it's, you know, it's been quite confusing to get a sense of, you know, what folks are dealing with in your area. So it's great to hear that those safeguards are in place and that you know, you've been vigilant with the testing. What kind of final question I wanted to touch on is, you know, kind of the ancillary benefits of a business like yours to the broader agriculture community. I'm just curious, you know, how you guys have been received and, you know, how you see yourself kind of fitting in with other producers in the area.
We've been to several local food expos. You know, we're involved with the Department of Agriculture, and we're very connected to what's going on in West Virginia and, you know, and other areas. I think we're unique in this area and, you know, the southeast of Mid-Atlantic that nobody else is doing this that we know about. And we really meet a need to have a locally or regionally produced salt. It's very unique, and it's, you know, mineral rich. And I think that there's a market for us, you know, with chefs who are really looking to source their products locally and regionally. Sean Brock of Husk restaurants in Charleston and Nashville, and McCrady's is a big proponent of ours, and Spike Garrity of Woodbury Kitchen in Baltimore, who is a front runner of sourcing ingredients from independent producers, got in his car as soon as he heard about us and came down here 6 hours to see what we were doing. He was so excited. And so I think that it's really meeting a need, and as consumers become more and more aware of their food sources, it's important, not just for salt, but for any of their foods. And that's really part of our mission and philosophy, is to improve people's health. And if you salt your own food rather than eating processed foods, you're going a long way to being a healthier person. So,
awesome. Well, Nancy and Lewis, thank you so much for joining us on the Farm Report today. It was really great to have you on.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Definitely. So if folks want to find out more, like I said, that website again is www.jqdsalt.com. You can also find them on Twitter at jqdsalt. And this program, obviously, like all 30 of our live weekly shows, is available for free. You can find us on our website, www.heritageradionetwork.org. We are a member-supported organization, so if you believe in our work and want to support what we do, click that Donate tab and become a member today. You can also find all of our programs on iTunes and Stitcher Smart Radio. Thanks so much for listening, and stay tuned in.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.